Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places. Welcome to Forward Thinking.
Welcome, everyone, to Forward Thinking, the podcast where we talk about the future. I'm Jonathan Strickland.
I'm Lauren Vogelbaum.
And I'm Joe McCormick.
Joe, the possessor of the Axe of Destiny.
Yeah. We now have an official forward-thinking plastic toy axe that was discovered in the House Tiff Works office toy box.
Yeah, so now it's ours. I don't know what we'll do with it or why it's forward-thinking, but...
We may do an episode on the future of axes and axe technology.
That's good. That's
the future
good.
Of plastics.
Of could plastic be. Axes, the, yeah.
Yeah, plastic yeah, axes in
that's
particular.
That's probably a quite different future than...
That's well. True. Well, that's not what we're talking about today, though. Today we're talking about brain-computer interfaces. What? Now you're looking at me like I want to talk about axes.
No, absolutely not. I have no idea what we talked about that.
Okay, so, brain-computer interfaces is what we're going to concentrate on today. And really, it's exactly what it sounds like. It's an interface that allows you to interact with a computer using just your brain power.
That sounds like science fiction.
Well, at one point it was just science fiction, but now it's science fact. And in fact, we've made a lot of progress in this field. Essentially, the way this works, you have to understand the way your brain works. You know, you have neurons in your brain,
mm-hmm.
and the neurons communicate. They pass along messages and commands to the various systems in your body using a combination of electric signals and chemical processes.
Right.
Right. And all these neurons in your brain are connected by things, axons and dendrites. Right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And they create complex patterns of electrical charges that surge back and forth. And this is what manifests as thought.
Right. And also as a command. So like
right.
when you
mm-hmm.
lift
yeah.
your arm, you know,
mm-hmm.
Or as Buckaroo Banzai would say, throw a harpoon. The neurons, because they are communicating partially through electricity, not solely through it, means that if we could find a way to detect electrical activity and to assign particular types of electrical activity to particular tasks, we could interpret that electrical activity and translate that into something that a computer could understand, like a command.
Right, yeah. Well, the interesting point, this goes all the way back to 1875, was the first time that someone noticed that the brain makes this electrical current. A British physician named Richard Caton, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And, this is not a new idea.
No.
It's certainly a fantastic one.
Right. Yeah, the whole idea of being able to harness computer power is relatively new. But the fact that we have,
right.
we've learned about the electrical activity in the brain, we've known about that for a while.
Right. And so essentially what your brain's doing is it's producing meaningful action based on electrical impulses,
mm-hmm.
which is actually the same thing a computer does, right?
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
Electrical impulses manifest as meaningful action.
Yeah. In that case, the electrical impulses tend to be on very tiny microprocessors and going mm-hmm. through extremely tiny channels on these microprocessors. We're talking about on the nanoscale. So if we were able to detect and interpret these electrical patterns that go on in our brains in a meaningful way, we could then create an interface with a computer and pass commands through thought. And in
wow.
fact, yeah.
Yeah,
it's
so
pretty crazy.
But
it's awesome.
But how do we read that? I mean, how do you figure out what's going on inside someone's skull?
Well, it's actually simpler than you might think. It's difficult and it's simpler at the same time. It's so your brain is producing electrical impulses.
Mm-hmm.
And in a way, it's not all that different than the data you'd create by punching keys on a keyboard or moving around a mouse. When your brain thinks a thought, something physical happens.
Mm-hmm.
If you have a way of detecting what that
physical
thing is that happens, then you have a way of creating input.
Right.
All you have to have is some kind of sensor or machine or way of gathering the input from the brain. That's the part that's hard.
Now, well, that's one part that's hard. Another
well,
part
yeah.
is hard is actually
interpreting.
Yeah,
teaching
the computer or the in
or
many
the
cases
person,
or the person
or the monkey
robotic limb.
Yeah,
you have to teach how to interpret a thought into an action, and that there's a part of a challenge of that is that two people could go into the same lab to have their thoughts analyzed, essentially. You could get in an MRI machine, for example, look at the brain activity, and you tell the person inside the machine, all right, I need you to think about lifting your left arm. And then you watch the parts of the brain that light up, and you say, all right, well, those are the parts of the brain that I want to concentrate on, because I'm designing the system so that the person will be able to control a robotic arm that would be in the place of their left arm.
Mm-hmm.
So
great,
but then you get a second person
exactly.
in there, and they think about it, and it's going to be slightly different places. So it's not like one size fits all.
Well, let's make this concrete. Let's talk about what we're actually talking about doing in terms of the technology.
Okay.
So what are some of the ways that people think they can actually detect electrical impulses in the brain and do something useful with them?
Well, the least invasive and the least expensive and probably the easiest would be the EEG.
Right. Well, first of all, you already mentioned MRI, and MRI can do this, but it can't do it on the go, right?
No.
MRI machines are very large and not portable.
Right.
Giant magnets involved.
And an MRI is really better used to, determine the best places to put an electrode to detect these electrical impulses.
So
you kind of use it in the testing phase, not in the execution phase.
Right. The MRI seems very useful for figuring out what you need to do, but not for real-time control.
Right.
You mentioned the EEG, the electroencephalogram.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And this goes back to 1924, by the way. A German neurologist named Hans Berger found the way to read current by electronic placement on the scalp.
So they put electrodes on the scalp itself, which detect any electrical activity.
Wait a minute, though. You'd have to think that if you're just putting electrodes all over your head, that's got to be a really high noise-to-signal ratio there.
Yeah, because your skull actually does block some of the electrical signals and also distorts some of them, which means that if you want to talk in terms of resolution, you would have low-resolution signals, meaning that that you would be able to detect activity, but your accuracy would be fairly low. So
be like taking directions from somebody who's on a cell phone inside a bomb shelter, you know.
Underwater, yeah.
Yes, it's exactly like that. Or, as I was going to say,
oh, sorry.
It'd be like if you were to put the electrodes on your scalp and the let's say that the hardware and software that you're working with allows you to move a cursor by concentrating on it on a screen. If you're wearing the electrodes on your scalp, then it may not be that accurate, and it may require you to spend a lot more time concentrating and trying to move that cursor than it would if you were to have a more invasive procedure.
Right. So here we come to the other and perhaps most promising technology, right, is the surgically implanted electrode.
Right. So in this case, you have gone in, you've actually removed part of the skull and gone into the brain, or you may just put the electrode on the surface of the brain, but there are also procedures where in order to get to specific parts
whichever
of the brain,
cortex is important.
You actually implant it directly into the brain. This also has some problems, obviously. One, being invasive surgery, there's always a risk there.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, that's a big decision. The second problem is, or potential problem, is that it can cause, over time, scar tissue can form over the electrode, which will create that sort of insulating problem that the EEG has, where you're going to get signals blocked or distorted because of the scar tissue. And then also, until recently anyway, it also meant that you had to be tethered to
a
device.
Yeah, you had a cord coming out of your head.
Yeah, you would have essentially a connection point that would extend out from your skull, and you would have to connect a wire to that. And that wire would be connected on the other end to whatever device it was that you were controlling, whether it was a computer or a robotic arm or whatever.
Though this problem has recently been somewhat conquered.
Yes.
We can talk about that in a minute.
But, yep.
So we're talking about neural implants, an electrode, a little piece of metal that's a chip that goes in your brain, and it takes those electrical impulses and it sends them to a computer. But we have to think that it can't be that easy, right?
It
can't just send the electrical impulse to the computer. There has to be really advanced software, right?
Right.
That understands how to deal with these impulses.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes.
Or based on an extremely complicated set of probabilities, can figure out, well, that little blippity blop probably means this thing. And
right.
As opposed to that little blippity blop, which, yeah.
Generally speaking, the way that I understand that this works is that it requires a long session or multiple sessions with scientists and doctors to go through the process of saying, all right, we want – let's say
it's a – Describe a test.
We'll give an example. Let's say it's a robotic arm.
Mm-hmm.
And they say, well, we want you to lift your left arm. And let's say it's a person who is fully capable of doing this.
Mm-hmm.
And so the person lifts their left arm and they interpret those signals and they say, all right, these are the signals we want. These are the signals that say lift the left arm for the robotic arm. And you repeat that test many, 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 many times to get as accurate a picture as possible mm-hmm. of the neural activity that's going on when you lift your left arm. And then you eventually say, this represents the input for the robotic arm to raise up. So then the next time you lift your left arm and you're hooked up to this system, the robot arm also lifts its arm. And you have to do the same thing for all the different commands. So things like gripping or twisting your wrist, unless you've actually designed the robotic arm to have some of these features automatically. I saw one video where the robotic arm would automatically grip something if the palm came into contact with an object.
Oh, that's cool. Okay.
So that you didn't have to go that extra step to think, make the fingers close.
At a certain point, the sensor is easier to produce than
right.
the brain transfer.
That makes it hard to do like an open hand slap, though.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you just
if
grip the person's face.
Trying to challenge someone to a duel.
No, instead
you end up pinching their cheek.
Yeah, yeah. So don't
future problems, man.
So, yeah. Right. Yeah.
So dueling of the future would be really difficult.
I would say that if my cheek were pinched by a robotic arm, I would consider myself chagrined.
Yeah.
But anyway, the
that would offend your honor, and you'd have to.
I would demand satisfaction. Yes.
Okay.
I'd have to go and grab our mystical axe. So the bringing it back. So the. Getting back to this, if you're talking about someone, now obviously one of the big potential uses for this technology is to help people who are severely disabled,
right.
who are perhaps paralyzed or quadriplegic and cannot do a lot of things for themselves. And so for them, it's a learning experience because they may not, they may lack the capability of doing whatever physical action they need to do to send the command. So it ends up being more of a learning process both for the person and for the machine.
Yeah. And luckily our brains are incredibly plastic and are very good at still continuing into adulthood, developing new neural paths in order to figure out these kinds of processes.
Right.
Yeah. You
right.
mean plastic as in changeable, not as in
yeah, not,
action
not
figures.
Actually. Right. Correct.
Right.
They are not made of vinyl
so,
that
well,
I know of.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you talked about helping people who have severe body disabilities. Mm-hmm. I've actually read about a few of these cases, mm-hmm. and they're kind of amazing stories. In the end of 2012, there was a woman who was quadriplegic, and from what I've read, it looks like neurobiologists at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center, they enabled her to, through a neural implant, so an electrode in her brain, control a robotic arm with which she could feed herself. And all it took her was a couple of days of practice before she could move this robotic arm with her brain
right.
to feed
wow.
herself a piece of chocolate.
So, yeah, the good thing is that people are very good at adapting to this and
right.
that we are getting better and better at building the hardware and software that can act as the other half of this system, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I saw an interesting exoskeleton thing, which I thought was pretty cool. It actually used an EEG cap. So, it was non-invasive. You know, the person, this was for people who could not walk for themselves. They would get into this exoskeleton. And the cap would go on top of their heads. It was called a mind walker.
Hmm.
And then they would, by concentrating,
was that a
they could
Stephen King novel from the 80s?
I hope not.
from one of those lost
it's
years.
Not, it's know. Not Sleepwalkers, I'll tell you that. It's a terrible, terrible movie.
Don't tell my dad. It's like his favorite movie.
Oh, no.
Oh wow. Okay. Well. I have no response to that. But at any rate, so there are other applications as well, but the main focus has really been on giving people who otherwise would have difficulty interacting with their environments more ability to do so through these interfaces. And you were alluding earlier, Joe, to the idea of the wireless approach, because mm-hmm. one of the big drawbacks to this was the fact that you would be tethered to a machine, and so you had even more limited mobility because of that.
Right.
Yeah. But, there were researchers at Brown University.
Yeah.
Who they came up with you just close it off. It's a wireless neural implant.
Yeah.
So it's doing the same job that these other ones we've talked about were. It's reading the electrical impulses in the brain and it's sending a signal, except this one is sending it wirelessly.
Yeah, it's got a wireless transmitter.
Yeah, mm-hmm. lithium ion battery. It's mm-hmm. rechargeable. It's its own little unit, and it transmits wirelessly to the computer that controls the device.
Mm-hmm. Right. Whether it's a computer or whether it's a robotic arm. And I think, according to what I was reading, it sounds like right now it has very limited operating range, about a meter away. Mm-hmm. So you're still.
But that's still way better than having a cord.
Sure.
Out of
your yeah, certainly. Definitely. And right now, no humans have had this implanted in their heads. They don't
know.
It's only been used on test animals. Monkeys and pigs so far. So no humans have had this procedure done, and don't know when that might happen, when that might change, but it's an interesting advance in the field.
So speaking of monkeys, I mean, there have been some really amazing studies done with monkeys in these neural implants.
Mm-hmm.
And one I was reading about, it showed that with some software tweaks, engineers had gotten it to where monkeys could, and keep in mind, these are monkeys, you know, they're not people who can understand complex instructions given by researchers.
Sure.
And can really respond to training like this. The monkeys figured out how to move a computer cursor into a target zone with, I can't remember exactly the percentage now, it was a significant percentage of what they could do with their arms, you know, just moving it by hand.
Sure.
Wow.
Well, there's also Idoia. Did you hear about Idoia?
Oh, yeah, the runner?
Yeah.
Wait, yeah.
Yeah, so we're talking about a 12-pound, 32-inch monkey
mm-hmm.
that through thought alone caused a 200-pound, 5-foot-tall humanoid robot to walk on a treadmill.
Wow, that's mm-hmm. both awesome and terrifying.
Yeah. The monkey was in North Carolina. The robot was in Japan.
Wow.
So cyborg monkey armies storming the walls of our cities.
Excellent.
Remotely controlled by their monkey true monkey masters. Overlords in the, you know, far away.
Wow. So
in their power chambers.
In the future there will be monkeys.
Yeah. Well, I mean, so we've been talking about how these in the near future neural implants and other brain-to-computer interfaces could be very helpful to people who suffer from, say, quadriplegia or any condition that's debilitating physically.
Sure.
You could create a robotic arm, or you could, you know, mess with a computer without being able to move your arms to move a mouse.
Right. You could communicate in ways that you might not have been able to before.
Right.
Right.
What happens when these things get good enough that, as we've talked about before, you might want them even if you don't need them?
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see. I mean, I would imagine that unless the state of the art is so amazing for the invasive forms, I can't imagine those ever really taking off, at least in the foreseeable future.
Depends on what they can do.
It would take
Futurists talk a lot about it. I mean, you know, you hear all the racket about, what is it, Homo cybernetics and
I'm thinking
you're talking about like a species.
Yes,
like space cyberneticus.
Yes, that kind of thing.
So I think that we're at least 50 years away from that personally. I mean, I think that's pretty safe
to say.
That's
a good number.
It's a good number, right?
50 years.
Well, at least 50.
We're always 50 years away from
it. But I mean, honestly, like, I can't. Mm. To me, it's hard. I say that, but then as a kid, I never would have imagined that I could carry something that would have access to pretty much the sum total of all human knowledge in my pocket. I didn't mm-hmm. think that was going to happen either, and it totally did. So I could be wrong about this. I think it's more likely that we will see, and we already have seen, things that are that are essentially using the EEG method mm-hmm. To act as some sort of control device or a toy. Like, I've seen the toys that you wear. It has a little helmet that you wear, and through concentration, you're supposed to be able to control the path of an object on a board. There's one I saw at CES a few years ago, and the way it worked was it had a little air vent that blew air straight up, and you put a ping pong ball, and it would suspend in the airflow, right? Mm-hmm. And that by concentrating, you could either increase the airflow and make the ping pong fly higher, or decrease it and make it fly lower. And a rotating obstacle course would go around, and you would have to try and maneuver the ping pong ball so it could fit through hoops or pathways or whatever.
So you're introducing the possibility of telepathic gaming.
That's
or telekinetic gaming.
That's the idea. I don't know how well these things really work.
Well, right now.
Yeah.
Right now, yeah.
But I'm saying that we already are seeing this sort of stuff.
Yeah, and they're still doing research about more, you know, non-invasive ways to figure this kind of thing out. And speech recognition technology, NASA, way back in 2004, actually, was doing a program that they were attaching sensors under the chin into the throat because they found out that when you just think about talking, your muscles still have some kind of electrical activity that can be picked up. And so, you know, stuff like that, I think, holds some amount of promise.
So you could, what you're saying, that by thinking a word, sensors on the muscles in your throat could follow commands even without you speaking.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, and on top of that, there are other alternatives that that might take some of the load off of the brain-computer interface train, I guess, because you could look at things like eye tracking software.
Sure.
And a lot of eye tracking software out there is getting pretty sophisticated to the point where if you are capable of moving your eyes, not everyone is. There's some people that, you know, locked in syndrome who are incapable of really making any sort of motion. But if you're able to move your eyes, then you're able to control elements on a computer screen. And I've seen some pretty cool implementations of that. And it's really just using cameras to track your eye movements and plot where you are looking on a screen and then interpreting that as a command. So there are other interfaces out there that we're seeing big advances in that could either complement or in some cases, depending upon the use case scenario, replace brain-computer interfaces. It all depends on what it's being used for and, you know, what you want the outcome to be. Obviously, it wouldn't work for every implementation.
So can you imagine any situation in which brain-computer interface would be really useful to a person who has otherwise full control of their body?
Spies? Immediately spies. Are you kidding me? Because if you are able to interact with a computer system without any overt sign that you are doing so, I would say that it would be very useful for a spy.
Yeah. So if you want to like start your tape recorder without touching it or saying anything. Yeah,
or you're sending a message saying, all right, I'm about to be eradicated, so you might want to burn my apartment, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I watched a lot of Bourne Identity the other day.
So. You know, even in our own industry, you know, if our producer Noel could send us a text message just by thinking about it without having to make the noise of typing on keys or, you know, wave his arms wildly or however else he gets messages across to us
It would be filthy. It would be a filthy message. Noel's just smirking at me right now and saluting me.
He is not saluting. He's sending telepathic messages.
I know
messages,
what he's
you're
doing,
not getting
Joe.
Them. You're not getting them.
I choose to ignore them. Well, anyway, that's kind of wraps up our discussion about brain-computer interfaces. It's a really interesting field, and I'm curious to see how that develops over time. And guys, if you have any suggestions for topics we should cover in Forward Thinking, please get in touch with us. Our email address is fwthinking@discovery.com. Please go to the fwthinking.com website, because that's where we have all our videos, our blogs, the podcasts, all our social media stuff is there. We look forward to hearing from you, and we will talk to you again really soon. Please put down the axe, Joe.
For more on this topic and the future of technology, visit forwardthinking.com. Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places.